Okay, so once again, hello to everybody, whatever time of day it happens to be, wherever you are. And indeed, if you have questions, please put them into the chat, and we'll leave ample time at the end of the class to look at all of the questions, or comments for that matter. I chose the topic of charoset for today for a variety of reasons. One is because it's delicious. And if we're going to talk about food, might as well talk about something that people enjoy eating. Food is an interesting thing. Sometimes we eat because we have to. That is to say, we need to nourish ourselves. We need to sustain ourselves. Sometimes we eat because we're obliged to. That is to say, that on, at least from a halachic perspective, on Shabbatot and on holidays, there's an obligation to have a festive meal. And therefore, you eat not just because it will be nourishing, but because it's an obligation. And then there are occasions, probably more frequently than the two I've already mentioned, where we eat simply because we want to. You know, chapanash, as we used to say. So because we eat for a variety of reasons, the foods that we eat tend to be of different varieties as well. Some we eat simply because they're nutritious, even though we don't really particularly enjoy them. Some we eat because they're enjoyable, even though they're not nutritious. In fact, sometimes we eat them because they're so enjoyable that we eat them, even though not only are they not nutritious, but doctors or dentists, for that matter, will actually tell us that eating too much of it is actually harmful. So when we look at particular foods, one of the things I said that we bear in mind is whether we're eating it because we need to, because we have to, or because we want to. Now, if we think for a moment about foods that are associated with religious occasions, then there's an additional element that comes into play, and that is that sometimes foods have a symbolic value. And the symbolism generally tends to be the name of the food, or at least that's what we know from Rosh Hashanah. On Rosh Hashanah, we have those things that are generically called simanim, basically mnemonic devices, that we eat certain foods, or if we don't eat them, we display them, because not the foods themselves, not the nutritive value, but rather the names of the foods tend to have symbolic value. And that gets a little complicated because the symbolic value is vested not in the colloquial English name of the food, nor for that matter, even necessarily in the colloquial Hebrew name of the food. Sometimes the symbolism is vested in the Aramaic name of the food, since when the Talmud was compiled and people were talking about different things that they served or that they displayed at their meals, they tended to refer to them by what was then the colloquial, and that was Aramaic. So for example, on Rosh Hashanah, we display carrots. The Hebrew word for carrot is gezer, and somehow that symbolizes the idea of gezar din, of an edict. And we eat them in anticipation of, or in order to basically pray for a good gezar din, for a good verdict, so to speak. Have a neighbor who made up his own simanim for Rosh Hashanah, lettuce and celery. And the invocation would be, let us get a raise in celery. Oh, I forgot. Yes, raisins and celery. Yes, lettuce, raisins, and celery. Of course, it isn't something that you'd see yourself eating on a, you know, even as a symbolic value. They kind of just don't mix. But you get the idea that sometimes, as I said, we eat things not because of the value that they represent in and of themselves, but because they are symbolic. When we come to charoset, we'll see a mixture of these different ingredients. We'll see that some of the function of charoset is, let's call it nutritive, that has something to do with the substance itself and the physical form of it and the physical function that it serves during the meal. And on the other hand, we'll see that another dimension of charoset is entirely symbolic. And in fact, when we look at the different recipes for preparing charoset, we'll see that there's basically an attempt to try to match the physical properties of charoset with its symbolic values. And with that, let's just simply go directly to the sources. And we start, not surprisingly, with a dictionary. After all, if you want to know what charoset is, what better place to look it up than in a dictionary? So here, in fact, I brought two dictionaries. One is the famous Marcus Jastrow's Dictionary of Targumim, Talmud and Midrashic Literature, because charoset, the word charoset, makes its first appearance in the Mishnah. Okay, and in his dictionary, as you see the first entry, Jastrow defines charoset as a pap, right? That's, you know, some sort of like a pulpish thing made of fruits and spices with wine or vinegar. So that's the physical description. The physical description of charoset, according to this dictionary, is that it's made of fruits and spices, okay? But since fruits and spices are dry, and this is going to be a pap or a paste, right? So liquid has to be added to it. And the liquid is either wine or vinegar. And what is its function? Used for sweetening the bitter herb on Passover night. Okay. So we're told both a physical description, right, of the charoset. It's a paste. Okay. We're told that it's made of fruits and spices mixed with wine or vinegar, and that it serves a utilitarian function, and that is that maror is bitter, and this, because it's made of fruits and spices, is obviously sweet, and therefore the sweetness of the charoset offsets the bitterness of the maror. Okay? Then if we read just the next line, you see that quoting the Tosefta in Masechet Pesachim, a very early Tannaitic source, it says, charoset, that's the letter chet with a shmitchik following it, it's merely an abbreviation, okay? Charoset, zecher latit. That charoset is somewhat reminiscent of clay. Not just any clay, but the clay that was molded into bricks by our ancestors during their slavery in Egypt. So that from this little definition, we discover not only the physical properties of charoset, not only a utilitarian function that it serves during the Seder meal, but we learn that it also has a symbolic value, and that is that it symbolizes the clay, right? A paste, right? The clay that was, I said, molded into bricks by our ancestors during their slavery in Egypt. The second definition is from a modern dictionary, Ernest Klein's Comprehensive Etymological Dictionary of the Hebrew Language for Readers of English. And here is definition of charoset. It is a condiment made of fruits and spices. There we go, same as Jastrow, with wine, okay, doesn't mention vinegar, but wine, and sugar, okay, used to sweeten the bitter herbs eaten on Passover night. So once again, we have the same physical description, almost identical, right? And the same identical utilitarian purpose, and that is offsetting the bitterness of the maror, okay? Now there's also, since it's an etymological dictionary, there's also an etymological note, and that is that the word, the noun charoset, is probably formed from the noun cheres, meaning clay, okay, in allusion to its clay-like color. Okay? Meaning, when Jastrow says zecher letit, that it is reminiscent of clay, he doesn't tell us which clay, right? And he certainly doesn't tell us that it has to be of a particular color. But Klein is telling us that it's an allusion to a clay-like color. Now, what color is clay? Now, arguably, one can produce clay of a variety of colors or hues, but arguably, what we're talking about here is the most frequent color in which clay, at least the clay that's used for the making of pottery, is formed. Because remember that a kli cheres, right, is something that's made of pottery, okay? And that would be something in the reddish family, okay? So what Klein has added to Jastrow is that one significant note, and that is that it's not only an allusion to clay in the symbolic sense, that just as our ancestors molded clay into bricks, so we have something at our Seder that looks like clay, right? But he adds the very significant note that it's allusion to clay on account of their sharing a color. Okay. With that, let's just look at the earliest sources that we have. Our introduction to Charoset essentially comes from the Mishnah. And since the Mishnah very often is not sufficiently self-defining, what I've brought here in both of these cases is one of the classic medieval commentators on the Mishnah, Rabbi Ovadia of Bertinoro in Italy, who lived in the second half of the 15th century. Okay? Obviously, if you care to, you can look up the Blackman's English translation of these Mishnayot. You can look them up in the very popular and very erudite Kahati Mishnayot. But I'm simply going to deal here with a medieval source, because we'll see later that this same Rabbi Ovadia Mibertinoro not only tells us the function that charoset serves during the meal, but he also provides a recipe for it. But we're not up to the recipe stage yet. So the Mishnah says, "Ein notnim kemach l'toch charoset o l'toch hachardal," that one should not put flour into either charoset or into mustard. "V'im natan," if however one puts flour into them, "yochal miyad," or "ye'achel miyad," it must be eaten immediately. We're talking about on Pesach itself. And apparently, why would you not put flour? Now, obviously, we're talking about flour that's kasher l'Pesach, okay? Why would you put flour into mustard? What would happen if you put flour into mustard? Mustard is sharp, okay? And therefore, the sharpness of the mustard would have a leavening effect on the flour. So if you put flour into mustard and you let it sit, it could very well turn into chametz. Therefore, if you put flour into mustard on Pesach, then you have to eat it immediately before it has a chance to leaven, before it turns chametz. And apparently the same thing is said about the charoset. Now, what is the ingredient in mustard that is acidic and that acts on the flour as a leavening agent? How do you make mustard? You grind up mustard seeds into a powder, but what do you mix it with? You mix it with vinegar. So again, why would you not mix flour into charoset on Pesach? Evidently, because the charoset contains that same acidic ingredient, the same vinegar as the mustard. So not only do we learn something here about the laws of Pesach, we learn something about charoset, that apparently it shares a physical property with mustard. And arguably, since we already know that from the definitions, that ingredient is the vinegar. Okay. And again, what does Rabbi Ovadia Bertinoro say in his commentary on this Mishnah? He defines charoset for us. Charoset, he says, davar sheyesh bo chometz umayim, something that contains vinegar and water, va'asui litbol bo basar. And it's a dip. It's something that was made for meat to be dipped into it. Another Mishnah, also in Masechet Pesachim, says, heviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'charoset u'shnei tabshilim. Again, once the meal is being served, okay, there's matzah on the table, there's chazeret, which is another name for maror, there's charoset on the table, shnei tabshilim. In fact, what he seems to be describing is a seder plate. okay, which we not only have like something that is reminiscent of the maror or symbolic of maror or charoset, or something that represents the Korban Pesach, something that's cooked, right? And he says that it should be there, the charoset should be present, af al pi she'en charoset mitzvah. Now, why is there matzah on the table? Let's say arguably he's talking about a Seder plate. Why would you have matzah on the Seder plate? Because it's a required ingredient of the Seder. Why would you have maror on the Seder plate? Because maror too is a required ingredient of the Seder. Why do you have the bones or the piece of meat, right, of seared meat, right? Because it is represented of the Korban Pesach, which again arguably is a necessary ingredient in the Seder. So if charoset keeps the company of the matzah and the chazeret and the shnei tavshilim, I might think that charoset too is a necessary ingredient in the meal. So the Mishnah tells us no. Charoset is present even though it is not a mitzvah, meaning it's not obligatory. And again, Rabbi Ovadia Bertonoro gives his commentary. He says, Shein charoset mitzvah. If it's not there to serve a mitzvah purpose, like the matzah and the maror, then what is it doing on my Seder plate? He says, Ela lirufu'ah. It's there for medicinal purposes, namely levatel sraf hachazeret, to counter the acrid horseradish, shera v'kasheh laguf ke'eres, because he says that chazeret, that horseradish, is as difficult for the body, or as possibly even painful or harmful to the body, as eres, as venom. Okay, so again, to counter the acrid horseradish, we have this ostensibly sweetened charoset. And here's what the main part of this class is. Just look at a variety of recipes, okay, for chazeret. I'm sorry, for charoset. Okay. So the earliest description we have of the ingredients, or the earliest recipe for charoset, comes from a 9th century book. It's called the Seder of Rav Amram Gaon. The word Seder here is not the Seder of the night of Pesach. The word Seder here is an alternative form of the much more common word Sidur. It means an arrangement. Rav Amram Gaon in the 9th century was the first Jewish authority to arrange the day's prayers. And therefore, his arrangement of the day's prayers was called a Seder, because the word Seder, like the word Sidur, means an arrangement. And here in talking about the prayers of Pesach, he talks a little bit about the Seder itself. And he says, Mivim lefanav charoset, that one brings out the charoset, she'osim oto bimekomenu min Timarim. So in Baghdad in the 9th century, the basic ingredient of charoset was dates. But it wasn't the only ingredient. Here we have another Gaonic responsum, and this one is undated, but it can come only from the 8th, 9th, or 10th century. So it's reasonably contemporary with Rav Amram Gaon. And again, I'm not going to go through the whole thing in Hebrew. It's clear enough in the English. It starts off in the Hebrew as mazkeret ech anu osin charoset ba-pesach. A reminder, if you will, how to make charoset for the Seder. And it says as follows, to 1/3 of a hin, that's a liquid measurement, of strong vinegar. So here we are again with the vinegar, as was implicit in the Mishnah, which compared it to mustard. Okay, we add 2 liters of white chestnuts that have been cooked before being ground, 2 liters of almonds, not shelled, 30 small dates, or 10 large ones, 800 nuts, 50 medium apples, or 30 large ones. clearly a recipe for quantity cooking. No individual is going to make that much charoset simply for his own or even for his extended family's seder. And then again, it continues with some more culinary advice. If one cuts down on the chestnuts and almonds and adds more nuts, it'll be better and nicer. 2 liters of white, spices, then we add spices to it. 1/2 ounce each of something called yenavar, I couldn't find exactly what it was, sanbal, which we call nard, right? They call it, gives them some colloquial name for it, aspic, canilla, askint, pepper. These different ingredients, obviously, they were well known in Baghdad or throughout Muslim world in the Middle Ages. They may very well have been brought into the Middle East from the Orient, since one of the things that we know is that Jewish traders were traveling to the Orient even before Marco Polo. So it could very well be that these are originally Oriental spices that then were brought into the Middle East and then became commonplace there. And he notes each ingredient should be ground fine individually along with the apples as appropriate, and then ground fine again all together along with the vinegar and the spices. So again, we see that the dates play a prominent role, but not an exclusive role in the preparation of charoset. We see again the importance of the vinegar and the spices, okay? And now we have the addition of apples and the addition of nuts, okay? And again, if I were to ask at this moment, why do you think they added apples and nuts to the dates? The answer might very well be strictly for gastronomic purposes. That is to say, people liked apples, people liked nuts. So if you're going to make a paste out of something to be sweetened, to serve at the Seder, to offset the bitterness of the maror, then why not put in things that people enjoy eating? Hold that thought. But before we get finished with the Middle Eastern recipes, we have, strangely enough, a recipe in a very unlikely source, in the Mishneh Torah of Maimonides. And in the section of the Mishneh Torah that's called Hilchot Chametz U'Matzah, laws that really pertain to what is chametz and how to dispose of it and the preparation of matzah, Rambam gives a recipe for charoset. Now notice, again, the beginning in Hebrew, hacharoset mitzvah midivrei soferim. Okay, you remember that Rabbi Ovadia Miber Tenoro made a point of saying, commenting on the Mishnah, that noted that charoset is not a mitzvah. Right? He said it was only for medicinal purposes. So Rambam is kind of stretching it. He can't claim that charoset is a Torah mitzvah because the Torah makes no reference to it. But he does, however, argue that it is a rabbinic mitzvah. And what is the purpose that it serves? He says, Zecher latit shehayu ovedin bo b'mitzrayim. As we said at the outset, that this is reminiscent of the clay, as I said, that they used in their building, right, in their building responsibilities as slaves in Egypt. And then he goes ahead and gives a recipe, v'chetzad osim ota, how do you make charoset? He says, we take dates, tamarim, or grogrot, dried figs, or tzimukim, or raisins, v'chayotze bahem, or similar things. Similar in what respect? Similar in that they're fruits, similar in that they're available, similar in that they're sweet, similar in that people enjoy eating them. Could be any of those or all of those. Okay? And what do? We grind them. But notice he says dorsim, which seems to suggest that they're ground not in a mortar and pestle, as you might assume, but actually they were really ground by people stomping on them. And then once again, we add vinegar and we add spices. Why? He says, to resemble clay and straw. Kemotit b'tevem. So here's a new thing, right? We've had the dates before. We've had the figs or raisins. And if we didn't have figs or raisins, we had apples or the like. That's not much of a difference yet, okay? But there is an additional note here, and that is that somehow it's not only supposed to resemble the clay from which they made bricks, but it's also supposed to resemble the straw, because if you recall from the biblical story, bricks were made by binding the clay with straw. Because you remember at one point when Pharaoh was kind of irked by Moses and by Aaron, so he sharpened his decree against the Jews, and he took away the straw. So they had to go out and they had to find their own straw. So we know that straw was a necessary ingredient in the bricks. So just as the clay was an ingredient, and that has to be reflected in the charoset, so was the straw an ingredient, and somehow the straw too has to be reflected in the charoset. Just how you get straw from into the charoset, we'll see. But now we move from North Africa and the Middle East to Europe. And it'd be curious to see to what extent do the recipes for charoset in Europe match those of North Africa and the Middle East, or to what extent are they different? Meaning, if the bottom line throughout is simply what's available, what's sweet, and what do people enjoy eating, then we might actually expect to be a big difference, because one can assume that the appetites of people in the Middle East and in North Africa were different from those of people in Northern Europe. If, however, part of it is not just the availability and the sweetness, but part of it is symbolic, then it could be that the symbolism limits the available ingredients. So we start with the earliest European recipe that we have, which comes from our good friends, the Tosafot, right? The students and grand students of Rashi in their notes to his commentary on the Talmud. Once again, of course, in Masechet Psachim, which is the Talmudic tractate that is devoted largely to matters associated with the holiday of Pesach, they refer us back to what we already saw, the Gaonic responsum, that explained that charoset is made of what? And you see I highlighted this in gray. Peirot shenidma lichneset Yisrael b'shir hashirim. Here we have a brand new element. Some idea that the charoset, the ingredients of the charoset, are to be those things to which the people, the Jewish people, is compared in what? In Shir HaShirim. First of all, you might not have known that in Shir HaShirim, the Jewish people are compared to fruits or spices. They are. But then you might say, well, why Shir HaShirim? So there is an association between Shir HaShirim and Pesach that might make it a logical source. First of all, there is a custom, and it's only a custom, in many but not all Jewish communities, that on Shabbat Chol HaMoed Pesach, you read the Megillah of Shir HaShirim. Okay. Why Shir HaShirim on Pesach? Because Shir HaShirim reflects a springtime milieu, right? Things are blossoming and the like. Love is blossoming, just like just like flowers are in bloom. Okay. So it evokes that kind of a springtime milieu, so to speak. Okay. Therefore, it wouldn't be strange to say that if you're looking for something that represents the Jewish people for the holiday of Pesach, you would look in Shir HaShirim. And to what are the Jewish people compared in Shir HaShirim? So here he gives us little snatches of wording from Shir HaShirim, in which, in fact, the Jewish people, actually in Shir HaShirim, it's the woman, the beloved, okay, who represents the Jewish people allegorically. Okay, so first she's compared to an apple. Tachat ha-tapuach orarticha. Okay, so that's apples. Okay, Then it says, Kefelach ha-rimon rakatech. That's the rimon, the pomegranate. Ha-te'ena chanta fageha. Te'ena is figs. Okay. Amarti e'ele bitamar. That's the date palm. Okay. Elginat egoz yaradati. There you have nuts. Okay. So you can see that all of these different ingredients are, say the Tosafot, are ground together into the charoset because they have this additional symbolic value of representing the Jewish people. But this one, he adds one to it, which is not on account of Shir HaShirim. And that's the final ingredient, shkedim, almonds, right, which we already saw in the Gaonic recipe, okay? Al shem sheshakad hakadosh baruch hu al haketz. This is more like a Rosh Hashanah kind of a siman, right? It has nothing to do with the item itself, but strictly with the word. Because the verb shin kuf dalid means to be diligent. And therefore, just as we believe that God is diligent and that God will bring the redemption at its appropriate time, so this notion of diligence is represented by almonds only because the word shkedim in almonds sounds like the verb shaked, to be diligent. So basically, these are pretty much the same ingredients that we saw in that earlier quantity recipe of the Gaonim, except that the responsum of the Gaonim made no mention of the association to Shir HaShirim. Okay. And again, continuing in the 12th century, but moving from France to Germany, we have again in a commentary on Masechet Psachim by Rabbi Eliezer ben Yoel Halevi, the Ra'aviyah, who tells us something interesting about figs. He says that some people don't use figs in charoset. Why? Because they say that when the figs are pressed together, right? You know, if you buy figs in a supermarket, they usually come in a circle, right? They're pressed together into a circle. Okay. So apparently that's customary. Whether the shape is necessarily a circle or whether the shape could be rectangular, figs tend to be pressed together. So apparently that when figs were pressed together, sometimes they would have water sprinkled on them. Why? For the flour to stick so that the figs didn't stick to each other, meaning that flour and water were used in the processing of dried figs. And if you have flour and water, then there could always be a problem on Pesach, as we saw in the earlier Mishnah about the mustard. Okay? Therefore, there are people who don't use figs in charoset because they're afraid that there are some chametz there. Others say, no, they don't sprinkle water on them. And in any event, if they sprinkle fruit juice doesn't cause chametz. It's not a leavening agent. But the Ravias says that people whose custom is to refrain from using figs in the charoset, he says, they should continue to refrain from using them. So we see that the question of figs is somewhat of a toss-up. Moving elsewhere and even later in time to Provence, that's between France and Spain, in the 13th or 14th century, we have one source that tells us that it's customary to put in apples, we've seen that before, dates, nuts, and now we see grapes. Grapes? Is grapes because we saw raisins before and raisins are just shriveled grapes? No. He gives the reason, he says, because there's another verse in Shir HaShirim that compares the Jewish people to a cluster of grapes. And if we're keeping to the principle that all the ingredients in charoset are those that symbolize the Jewish people, at least allegorically, in Shir HaShirim, then we can't leave out the grapes. The next source, actually two sources, are very significant because they are the Maharil, Rabbi Yaakov of Molin, who is one of the real go-to authorities for customs and liturgy in Ashkenaz in Germany throughout the Middle Ages and even the early modern period. And he says that charoset recalls the clay, Okay. And on top of the charoset, we put spices, cassia, cinnamon, and other spices. Now here, finally, right? Sliced lengthwise. Why? To recall the straw. Remember, we saw that if the charoset is supposed to be the bricks, then bricks are made not only of clay, but also of straw. So how do you get the straw into the charoset? By slicing the spices. And here when he talks about cinnamon, he's not talking about ground cinnamon, right? He's obviously talking about, you know, the herb itself. Okay. If you slice it lengthwise, he says, then the slices of cinnamon and the slices of other spices, you know, they look like pieces of straw. Okay. And the Maharil said that some also require the addition of rimonim, of pomegranates. Why? Again, because apparently it was either believed or it is so in fact that some ingredient, some property of rimonim, of pomegranates, is particularly good at dulling the bitterness of the maror. And another source, again from the Maharil. The Maharil ruled that one should be wary of those small grapes called raisins. Aha. Why? Because they get mixed together with dried figs in the same basket. And, right, that's the international sign for pilpul, right? And if we prohibit the use of dried figs because we're afraid that they might have come into contact with flour and water, right? Then we have to prohibit the use of raisins for the same reason. Okay. And here, as I promised you a while ago, is the recipe, the Italian recipe. Rabbi Ovadia of Bertinoro himself tells us that charoset is made of figs, hazelnuts, peanuts, almonds, and several types of fruit, including apples. Everything is ground in a mortar, not stepped on, mixed with vinegar, and topped with spices such as cassia and cinnamon, arranged, as we saw previously, like thin threads to recall the straw. And he adds one more important thing. He says that it should be ave, it should be thick, zecher letit, because if it's supposed to be reminiscent of the clay, which was molded into bricks, right, then it can't be too liquidy, right? It has to be a paste, it has to be thick. Okay. Now, the idea of introducing pomegranates, as we saw, was mentioned previously. Okay. Is also in another source. I skip it. It's merely just a duplication. But here we have some out of the box charoset. Okay. And this comes from a relatively modern source. Okay. This is Rabbi Chanoch Teitelbaum, a Hasidic rabbi in Galicia, in the early part of the 20th century, who was very interesting because he apparently taught himself some modern things like philology. And he has a very interesting philological observation. In Shir HaShirim, it is indeed true that the people of Israel is compared metaphorically to a tapuach. And it's also true that if you look up the word tapuach in just about every Hebrew English dictionary that you can find, it'll define tapuach as an apple. But there's a big problem with that. If you like apples and you want to buy apples at a fruit stand in Israel, okay, they have a very limited assortment of apples, very limited assortment, and certain species of apples are only available if they're imported. So the question is it logical to assume that the tapuach that's mentioned so prominently, both in Shir HaShirim and in the book of Yechezkel, okay, and to which the Jewish people is compared, does it make sense that it would be something that is as unusual as an apple? And again, I said, just relative to the abundance with which other fruits grown in the land of Israel, right? Apples are relatively scarce. Okay. So this Rabbi Teitelbaum came up with an interesting observation. His observation basically is that if you look at the Aramaic Targum, the ancient Aramaic translation of the Bible, you'll find that their definition of tapuach is not an apple. Their definition of tapuach, he maintains, is, interestingly enough, what we call an etrog. And therefore, Rabbi Teitelbaum's argument is, put apples into the charoset, put dates into the charoset, put a variety of spices and nuts into the charoset, don't forget the vinegar or the wine, mix into it. But he maintains that if you want it to be representative of those things to which the Jewish people were compared allegorically in Shir HaShirim, and one of those things is a tapuach, then, says Rabbi Teitelbaum, your best bet is to make sure that you also add an etrog to it. Because just in case the Targum is correct and the biblical tapuach is not an apple at all, but it's a citrus, then you should add an etrog as an ingredient to it in order to make sure that you basically have covered all of your culinary bases. There's actually a little more to it than that, which isn't reflected necessarily in this text, and that is that the Talmud itself also finds it important and noteworthy to compare the first night of Pesach to the first night of Sukkot. You know, the first night of Pesach and the first night of Sukkot have other things in common. Each one of them is observed on the 15th day of a month, okay? And the 15th day of a significant month. So simply starting with the premise that Pesach and Sukkot have something in common simply because of the time during which they are scheduled during the month, the Talmud then goes ahead and it also draws other connections between the two holidays. So the idea that somehow we can connect Pesach and Sukkot by putting etrog into the charoset is certainly very much in keeping with this Talmudic notion. But here is something even further out. Again, a reasonably modern source, the Chida, Rabbi Chaim Yosef David Azulai, right, lived in Italy, the land of Israel, in the late 18th, mostly in the late 18th century. And he notes as follows, he says that there are those who put some clay or brick dust into charoset to recall the clay. You see the first line, it's highlighted in yellow. Yesh misimimbo ma'at chomer o grirat levena. That there are some people who mix into their charoset some chomer. Chomer means clay, but it's interesting because the shoresh chet mem resh also means red. Right? Red. It's specifically chemar is reddish clay. Okay? So here, it's not only reminiscent of the clay because of the substance, it's also reminiscent of the clay because of the color. Okay? Now, or greirat levena, greira is to rub, right? So if you rub a brick, right, what do you get? You get brick dust. Okay? So he says that he has heard that there are people who mix clay or brick dust into charoset. But his reaction is, he says, I was frightened to see such nonsense, he calls it. Why? He says, on Purim, do these people draw blood because it's reminiscent of of Haman's fatal edict, meaning there's a point at which you can be carrying something figurative too far. One is obliged on Pesach to transform sorrow into joy and to transform evil into goodness. And then he goes ahead and he says that really, you know, what it seems to be is based on a misreading of a text. But here's a curious thing. Little, I write, did the Chidah imagine that something quite similar would find its way into the battlefields of the American Civil War. In 1862, the Jewish Messenger, which was one of the few Jewish periodicals in those days, published an account of a Seder as it was celebrated in West Virginia by Union soldiers. Apparently one of them, somebody named J.A. Joel of the 23rd Ohio Volunteer Regiment, wrote either to his family describing the Seder, or maybe even wrote a letter to the editor of the Jewish Messenger describing it. Okay. He writes that a fellow soldier returning from home leave just before Pesach brought for his fellow Jewish soldiers matzot and haggadot. The rest was ad hoc, meaning they had to make their own Seder ingredients. And here is the original text as it was published in the Jewish Messenger. He wrote, "We sent parties to forage in the country for Passover food. While a party, that is, some soldiers went out to look for ingredients, others stayed to build a log hut for the services." Like a shul, okay? "We obtained 2 kegs of cider, okay, a lamb, several chickens, and some eggs." Okay? So that those are necessary ingredients for a Seder meal. "Horseradish or parsley," meaning the maror and the karpas, "we could not obtain. However," he says, "in lieu, we found a weed whose bitterness, I apprehend, exceeded anything our forefathers enjoyed." Meaning, they couldn't find traditional horseradish, right? But they did find something, some vegetation that was considerably bitter. "We had the lamb, but we didn't know what part was to represent it at the table." Meaning, not in terms of what would they eat during the meal, but what goes on the Seder plate. Okay? Obviously, the Haggadah that one of them brought back was not the traditional Maxwell House Haggadah with a picture of the Seder plate on the cover. So they didn't know which part of the lamb should be represented on the Seder plate. But he says, Yankee ingenuity prevailed. What did they do? It was decided to cook the whole and put it on the table. Put the whole lamb on the table, right? That way you're sure to have the right part represented. Then we could dine off it and be sure we got the right part. And here's the clincher. The necessaries, that is to say the necessary ingredients for the charoses, we could not obtain. So we got a brick, which, rather hard to digest, reminded us by looking at it for what purpose it was intended. I think there's a rather fitting way in which to conclude this. Because here we have people who did their best, right? Where they could obtain ingredients or even approximate ingredients to actually prepare traditional Pesach foods for the Seder, they did. Where they couldn't obtain the necessary ingredients, then they resorted to Plan B. And Plan B, as you remember from the opening, is when things are brought to the table, not necessarily because of what they are physically, or even necessarily because we intend to eat them, but because they, or even some cases, the names by which they are known are the symbols in and of themselves. So here they understood that charoset is supposed to represent the clay from which the bricks were made by our ancestors in Egypt. Absent anything from which they could manufacture ersatz clay, what we call charoset, they resorted, as I said, to the completely symbolic, and they actually did not eat, but at least they laid a brick upon the table to remind them of the charoset. And with this, we'll see if we're generated, woo, seem to have generated quite a bit of comment. Let's see what we can have here. The sources are posted. Other people have celery at Rosh Hashanah. Vinegar is surprising. No, it doesn't lend sweetness. No, but it counters the acidic part of the maror. And that's why when they say wine, there's two aspects to wine also. One is that if it's a really dry wine, then it's close to being vinegar. So it has that property. The other is that since ideally at the Seder on Pesach, you have red wine, then if you haven't already achieved a red color to your charoset by virtue of the apple skins, by virtue of the cinnamon, by virtue of the other ingredients, then you can turn it red by adding the wine to it. Chazeret isn't really horseradish. Okay, I skipped that source on the source pages. You're welcome to look it up at your leisure. The medieval German sources that talk about the Seder use a German word for maror. And the German word they use for maror is merretish. Merretish. Retish, radish. Okay? So merretish is a type of radish. Okay? The word, the old German word mer, like the Latin word mare, means a sea. And actually, in reality, merretish is some sort of radish that grew near the sea. Okay? However, in other European languages, the word mer, like the English word mare, was understood to be a type of a horse. That is how merretish came to be understood as horse radish rather than as sea radish. But chazeret in any event is not necessarily horse radish, but since the Middle Ages, that certainly became its most frequent representative. Okay. Iraqi Jews make charoset from dates. As I said, they've been doing that for 1,000 years. Okay. Adding pepper to something sweet. I don't recall that. I'm not sure. It may be what kind of pepper. And again, it may simply be again because it counters the bitterness. I don't know. Might be ginger. Could be. Syrians make charoset with dates. Again, we've seen that all along. Apples could be added for thinning the texture. I don't know enough about either apples or about cooking to have a reasonable opinion on that. Okay. Possibility that Shirashirim fruit references were triggered by the time of Pesach and existing tradition of charoset. Not likely, certainly not. If you believe that Shirashirim indeed was written by King Solomon. That doesn't seem likely at all. Cassia is a variety of cinnamon. Thank you. Italy may use figs and raisins, have been dried by people connected to the Jewish community special for Pesach. Could be. Look, you know, they didn't have an OU. So, you know, what made things kosher la Pesach clearly was that they had certain local traditions. And as long as you abided by those local traditions, then at least everybody locally understood that you were kosher la Pesach. Okay. You're absolutely right that I don't want to get into the issue of kidney out. Okay. Right. Soldier eating maror. Yes. Well, I don't know what kind of cider they drank, whether it was apple cider, whether it was wine cider, don't know. Okay, that basically does it. Thank you all so very much, Shira. You have a postscript?
Just to say, keep watching, keep listening, keep donating so we can provide stimulating Torah virtually everywhere. And so happy to see everybody. Pesach kasher v'sameach. Stay well. And thank you, Dr. Sokolow.
Pleasure as
Thank you,
always.
Dr. Sokolov. Excellent. Excellent.
Pleasure as always. Those of you see the musical, the musical among you, see you again in the Tuesday after Pesach.
Thank you. Hello
Okay.
to Rosie.
Hey,
Thank you, thank
Kuda.
you, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
In Israel, in my home, we did not use vinegar because vinegar in Hebrew call it chometz. And the fact that I had those three letters, it did not enter. Did not enter. We use lemon instead of vinegar.
I know people who don't eat tomatoes on Pesach.
Okay,
If you ask
why?
them why they don't eat tomatoes on Pesach, there are some people who say we don't eat tomatoes on Pesach because tomatoes are acidic.
Okay.
Some people say we don't eat tomatoes on Pesach because they're red.
Okay.
And some people say that we don't eat tomatoes on Pesach simply because our ancestors didn't eat tomatoes on Pesach, which is simply by virtue of the fact that it was almost impossible to get tomatoes in Northern Europe in the spring. So
Okay.
there you go. Bye all. Take care.
Thank you. Thank
Thank
you.
you.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach. Bye bye.